American Social History Podcasts are a production of the American Social History Project, Center for Media and Learning at the City University of New York Graduate Center. Visit us online at ashp.cuny.edu. In part one of this podcast, Gregory Downs of City College of the City University of New York speaks to New York City teachers about Henry Adams, a former slave who organized freed people to emigrate to Kansas in 1879. This talk took place on July 19, 2010, at the Graduate Center.
And so what I'm going to talk to you about today is what I think is in many ways one of the most interesting, but also in a lot of ways at every level, one of the most difficult time periods to teach, which is Reconstruction. Reconstruction is a challenge because it doesn't fit into any of the sort of basic storylines that a lot of both students of history and practitioners of history, or of history teaching or history writing, fall into. In other words, there are stories that are purely stories of triumph, and there are stories that are really stories of oppression and of defeat. And Reconstruction is a strange one because it's got moments of one and moments of the other. And it's really easy to fall into teaching it in a way that obscures the one, that makes it, that sort of obscures the story of defeat into a story of triumph. Or more consistently, it's easy to turn it in the opposite way and to have it be so purely a story in which the end result, that Reconstruction ends, that in some ways it fails, is the sort of term that scholars over and over use, the failure of Reconstruction, that because it fails, to allow the ending to predetermine the way that we teach it from the beginning, as if its end and failure was preordained, was born within it, and no other outcome was possible. And so it makes it in this sense, you know, both of those are alluring stories, right? They both exist out there as stories that can be told. The first story, the story of the success of Reconstruction, or the triumph of Reconstruction, would be a story of that there's only two places in the Western Hemisphere in which emancipation leads to immediate freedom and enfranchisement, and those are Haiti and the southern United States. That's it. So that's a story of a spectacular expansion of voting rights, a spectacular expansion, a sort of almost unprecedented expansion of rights. The more common story, the failure story, is a story of what happens 12, 13, 14 years later, which is the, and in some cases 20, 25, 30 years later, depending upon the state, but the retraction of the those voting rights, this great cutting back of democratic promise, disfranchisement, segregation, Jim Crow, the growth of the South that'll become familiar to people by the early 20th century, a South of sharecroppers, of extremely low voter participation, of a hard series of segregation, of public violence and lynchings and so on. And that story is also a powerful story. What's interesting about Reconstruction is that both stories are true. And figuring out how both stories can be true, and figuring out what it means to think of a moment that has such incredible promise and also such an extraordinarily painful, disappointing outcome, I think is really a hard thing to teach, but an interesting thing to teach, because it opens up. It opens up possibilities to talk to people about what it is to students, about where it is that moments of promise come from, and why it is that they fade. And that we can take seriously the possibilities of what existed in Reconstruction at the beginning without pretending that those possibilities don't go away. And that similarly, we can talk about the ways that those possibilities get cut back at the end without pretending that there weren't moments of fluidity early on. And so to me, it's a sort of always a difficult thing to teach at almost any level, but a really interesting thing to teach because it throws open a lot of questions. Rather than a storyline that sort of carries its way on a single track, it's a story that throws open a lot of questions, and questions that I think, you know, lead to kind of tensions, complications, challenges that continue to shape the nation, that continue to shape the way that politics is organized and what's possible and what's not. What I want to talk to you about in Reconstruction is about understanding this period, which classically, some people started in the wartime, some people started with the close of the war, but classically covers the period from the emancipation of slaves into sometime between 1876, a really classic end of Reconstruction, with a presidential election that involves a compromise in which the Republican Party agrees to pull troops from the South
in order to obtain the presidency in this disputed election, like a 2000 Gore Bush election on steroids, where nobody can say, you know, who won. And, you know, they agree to this compromise that ends classically Reconstruction in the South. Or for other people, Reconstruction ending more gradually in the 1890s to the early 1900s with the completion of disfranchisement and the erection of a very narrowly based societies of segregation, Jim Crow in the South. So what I want to do is to look at what happens if we think of that period with a highlight upon the things that they at the Social History Project worry about and think about and try and help you to convey to your students, which is what was the role of regular people of, you know, these are sort of all fraught terms, but what was the role of grassroots politics in shaping both its potential, but also in shaping its decline? And thinking about looking at the lives of workers, of sort of, you know, non-elite actors, as playing a key role in blowing up Reconstruction and making it somehow mean something more than anybody expected it to. And the sort of first part of the story that most people find exciting or interesting or hopeful to teach, that something that looked like it was going to be small, all of a sudden, to many people's surprise, turned out to be big. But also to thinking about the ways that grassroots politics or everyday people participated in the opposite, in the incredible constraints put on Reconstruction at the end. And so that rather than, it's very alluring, I think, to teach the story as grassroots politics makes it big and the cutting off of grassroots politics makes it small. But in an interesting way, Reconstruction really presents us with something else that I think is an opening but a dilemma, which is that if an interest in grassroots politics can show us how the people can play a role in making society expand, it can also show us how sometimes at the grassroots level is the basis where some of the reactionary forces or where some of the forces that'll pull back also aren't always imposed from above, but sometimes are themselves generated among different groups, but different groups of working people or laboring people. So that's what I'm going to be talking about today. When I talk about it, I want to start with a long story because I think it's an amazing story, and I think it is a kind of story that you can teach because it opens up things, but it's also extremely complicated, but it does have this biographical line, and that I think is amazing for the ways that it shows how many twists and turns there are in Reconstruction. Because I think the other thing that Reconstruction can help us with is to do what historians always worry about, which is sequence. That while it can be tempting to look backward on the past and to take things out of their context and to see things happening solely in a sort of timeless moment, in which you're really evaluating people morally, one of the things that's interesting is how much sequence matters. How people who don't believe one thing at one moment, 12 months later, events have shifted their views. But sequence shows us how, in some senses, how things change, other than just sort of a personal revelation. But how things change. How is it that events transpiring around people help lead them to make shifts? So that's the other thing I think that's amazing about this story, is what it tells us about how one very clear, thoughtful person is making very different judgments at different moments of Reconstruction, not because he loses will or energy or, you know, has, you know, delusions, but because he's reading the world around him a little differently, because the world around him is different at different moments. And so this is a story about the education of Henry Adams. Some of you may know from, you know, joyful experience, or more likely at this point, not very joyful experience, that there is a book called The Education of Henry Adams. How many of you have read that? There we go. A very different book than what I'm going to describe to you. That book is a backward-looking memoir. Henry Adams is the scion of the Adams family of Massachusetts, the grandson and great-grandson of politicians of John Adams, John Quincy Adams, the son of another distinguished ambassador, vice president, and one of the first professional American historians, professor at Harvard, leaves it, becomes a writer, and grows increasingly skeptical about the United States and its future over the late 19th, early 20th century, and becomes increasingly skeptical about modern society. And so The Education of Henry Adams is sort of about that, how he got educated toward giving up. That's a very crude, you know, that's a very crude representation of it. And the Henry Adams I'm going to talk to you about, though, is quite a different character. And in many respects, his story is about the miraculous ways that people cannot give up, even as certain avenues get closed, and about the ways that they can make different types of judgments. So this Henry Adams and his education, I'm going to start with one of the things that comes toward the end. 1880, 36-year-old former slave named Henry Adams goes in front of a United States Senate committee. The committee is investigating the migration in 1879 of, it's hard to get an exact number, but something on the order of tens of thousands of former slaves, mostly from Texas, Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, to Kansas, and to lesser degrees, Oklahoma. So, Senate committee. They take an enormous amount of interest in this. Now, the reasons for their interest, we'll talk about. They have particular reasons for their interest. But they collect 1,700 pages of testimony. Testimony, much of which you can find online, thanks to Google Books, including the entire testimony of Henry Adams, which is fascinating. So they take an enormous amount of testimony from an amazing range of people. In other words, you kind of assume there's sort of a predetermined cynicism that people have that when you look back, you're going to be hearing from the, you know, grand exalted leader of this organization and the grand exalted leader of that organization. And yet, amazingly, you read this testimony from a variety of committees in the 1870s up through the 1890s. And there are really people coming on, and there are certain very famous leaders, but there's also people coming in, and they're like, I'm a sharecropper, I work, you know, a few acres of land. And the questions they get are amazingly wide-ranging, from the very sympathetic to the very antagonistic, for the simple reason that, like in any political committee, there's people on one side of a political fence and on the other, and they're trying to use these, you know, these witnesses to buttress their position, to build up the ones who the senators agree with, and to tear down the ones that they disagree with. But they're fighting themselves, the senators on the committee, and so that creates some moments of real openness, where one side starts bringing in and trying to pack the hearings. So Henry Adams comes in to talk about it, and he tells them a story that for a long time scholars were extremely dubious of. There is no question that there is a natural human tendency for people at moments when they're asked, why are you important, to maybe inflate the answer a little bit, right? You know, that especially in an era before Google searches, if somebody said, you know, they wrote 5 books and it turned out they wrote 2, who would know, right? You know, there's a natural human tendency for people to sort of let some air in when they're asked why you are important. And some of the things that Henry Adams said were so amazing that people just assumed, well, it can't be true. And then, starting in the 70s, a scholar named Nell Irvin Painter wrote a book about the Exodusters then updated a couple of other times in the last 10 or 15 years, in which a remarkable amount of it does seem to have been true. Henry Adams said, I am the leader of an organization of 100,000 people. Now, 100,000 people is a pretty big organization. Not if you're starting a Facebook campaign to protest Facebook or something, right? Then you can get like 1 million people in your organization in a second. But if you're trying to start an organization like he's talking about, in 1870s, an organization of black people in 1870s Louisiana and Mississippi, 100,000 people is a lot of people to reach, right? Think about the communication problems, right? No phone, barely, there telegraphs exist, but there's barely telegraph service to these things. They're going out and getting people one-to-one, going from little town to little town, in one of the most agrarian societies in the world, in which there's no major cities to collect people up other than New Orleans, which in some ways he's very skeptical of or fearful of. He says, I am the leader of a group of 100,000 people. And what they want to do is they send out a group of people to investigate how were things actually, right? They're hearing rumors. What was going on in this part of the South? What was going on in this part of the South? How were things, what was actually happening at these key moments when looking back, historians would call the end of Reconstruction? And he said, and we sent out one group of people and said, if we go to Virginia or North Carolina, will that be better? And they go out and they travel there, right? They send out other people and they go to Kansas. And they're like, if we go to Kansas, how will that be? Another group of people is writing to an old, almost defunct organization called the American Colonization Society, started by slave owners like Henry Clay early in the 19th century to emancipate slaves but send them to Liberia. And they played a key role in the founding of Liberia, a sort of solution to the problem of slavery by Whiggish slave owners that said, you know, the way to end slavery is to move slaves back to Africa. Never, it was in such an enormous, it was never a politically popular position on any side of the equation, and it was such an enormously expensive proposition that it never got that far. But thousands of people were sent. Most African Americans in the period of slavery and after resisted this idea that they said, you know, I'm born in America, I'm here, I'm not going back.
But there were certain people, especially slaves, where they would say, you can stay in slavery, or if you let us buy you out, then we'll send you to Liberia, to where that seemed like a proposition. But in the war, when Lincoln considers funding the Colonization Society, a group of ministers, black ministers in D.C., come in and say, they're not going to go. Right? They're born here, their lives are here, their families are here, their peoples are here. But after the war, during Reconstruction, Adams and other freed people start to say, maybe this isn't our place. And to write to the Colonization Society, which at this point is just a couple of secretaries in Boston, and to say, you know how you used to not be able to get people to go? Well, we've got tens of thousands of people who are thinking about it. What can you do for us? And this sort of strange aftermath of the Colonization Society history, which is that when they were powerful, they didn't have people. And in the moments when they're fading and almost about to shut down, there gets this resurgence of interest among Southern, or this first surgence of interest among Southern black people, led by Adams. All of these petitions and so on are all saved in D.C., and this is some of the things that convinced Painter and Steve Hahn and others of how accurate Adams was. You can go through and see the names on the petitions and start to count up. I don't especially advise you to count to 100,000, but you can start to see that it builds up really quickly, individual names and individual places. And he says, the story that he tells is, he says, it's an amazing story, but it's also in some ways a very telling story. It's amazing because he's an unusual character. He's an unusual figure for any group of people at any time. He was an organizer who can put together 100,000 people without social networking. That's a hard skill for anybody to have. He was a faith healer who was credited with healing people across Louisiana and in parts of Mississippi, and who at times talks about this sort of tension in which he's trying to run out the door to go to these meetings, and there's another group of people there saying, we want you to heal so-and-so who's got some sickness. And he's also, at the same time, an extraordinarily successful businessman. And so he's got these sort of complex motives, these complex skills. He had been born a slave in Georgia. During slavery, he got not recognized by law, but recognized by many of the people around him, ownership of property, which was something that scholars have increasingly found was sort of recognized not ever by law. By law, slaves being property could not own property, but was recognized in fact on many plantations, not all, but where certain slaves, or more likely even certain slave kin groups, would acquire some sort of use right over different pieces of property, often farm animals. Now, could a owner take it back from them? Absolutely. Under the law, everything belonged to the owner. But in a way, in many plantations, there was some fluidity about what it was that a slave could claim ownership of. And an owner who's trying to manage a group of hundreds of slaves might decide that if one kin group of 50 or 60 of people, cousins and so on, can claim ownership of certain parts of the property, and in that sense, stay invested in the plant, invested the wrong way, but stay focused on the plantation in a way that it became a way of buying off different, in some ways, of buying off different groups of slaves. Adams acquires, even for that tiny group of people who do this, an amazing amount of property. 3 horses, a buggy, a carriage to drive, and a good deal of money in gold and silver. And he uses it in the period after emancipation to go around, he goes to Shreveport, to the big town, such as it is in North Louisiana, to go to Shreveport and to start a variety of businesses. He's hired to manage plantations for people. He's hired to manage wood mills for people. He's investing. He buys a good deal of property, $1,500 worth of personal property of homes and land in Shreveport, which is a great deal for 1870s. And he also begins peddling. He goes around the state and he's buying and selling things. And as he does that, he has this amazing chance to learn about conditions across the state because he's moving around all the time. And in an era before, there's widespread, there are newspapers in the South, but not that many. They're not that well distributed. And in an era before the kinds of communications we take for granted, these people who are moving around are the people who are actually able to accumulate knowledge, information. And as he's moving around, he comes back to these sets of ideas, these sets of observations, that throughout the South, throughout Louisiana at first and later throughout the South, that
certain things are happening over and over. That the black codes, which we'll talk about in a minute, passed by the state legislatures right after the war, are aiming to recreate something so akin, very akin to slavery, without the prevention of marriage or without forced sale of people, but in every other way to recreate as much of slavery as they could on these plantations. That black laborers are being beaten, that they're being defrauded, they're being forced to sign contracts that that are defrauding them and that are illegal. They're not able to negotiate. They're not able to go from place to place. They're being whipped on the roads. And he comes back with this sense of what's going on, and he joins the Union Army. So unlike a lot of slaves who joined the Union Army in the 1862 or 1863, he joins after the war, serves in the Union Army as a collector of intelligence, again, traveling around, and he's also, not surprisingly, given the other skills he has, he's the quartermaster. He's the manager of supplies for the Union Army in Louisiana because it's extraordinary talent that he has. Again, collects information. Comes out of the Union Army in 1869, 1870 into Shreveport and starts using the money that he's accumulated to buy property, to set up business, and also he and a bunch of other Union veterans who come out create what they call the committee. It's only open to black male veterans, 50 or 60 of them. And in fact, many of them, almost all of them, unlike our vision of who are the sort of political leaders of Reconstruction, of these high-status people who had been north, lived in the North before the war, or had been free in the South before the war. This is almost exclusively rural people, almost exclusively those who had been slaves, and many of whom, like Henry Adams, only learned to read in the Army in the 1867, 1868, 1869. So something much closer to on the ground. They say they don't want to be, they don't trust politicians. Well, see, they believe in politics, but they don't trust politicians. And not only do they not trust white politicians, or they certainly don't trust white Southern politicians, which seems very understandable, they also don't trust black politicians. Some of this has to do with the power of New Orleans and Louisiana. And so they say, we don't want to become a tool of them. We want to keep control of our organization. And this committee then systematically starts to travel through the South and to come up and to say, we don't know if we have a future here in Louisiana. Where can we go? And these start to become the seedlings of what will develop later in the decade into this exodus. Are things better in the Upper South? What do people say if we go to Tennessee or North Carolina? What is going on? They start to collect lists of what's going on. Where are people being attacked? At the same time, people in and around Shreveport, ex-Confederates, start to realize, even though he's not making an effort to be that much of a public prominent person, he never runs for office, start to realize the threat that Adams poses. And when he's renting houses, the landlords go to the local planters, go to his landlords and say, either kick him out or we're going to burn your house. When he gets jobs, they go to the plantations and they say, this guy is trouble. Get rid of him or we're going to shut down your plantation. This is partly what drives Adams to then say, I'm going to buy my own house and see what they do. I'm going to start my own businesses, see what they do. He stopped on the road, and a group of men threaten him and say, either leave Louisiana or we're going to kill you. And he says, why talk in the future tense? Let's do it right now. Right? He's, you know, an unusually brave person. He says, let's go. And they go away. He's also, so his personal experience is confirming what he's seeing in other people. This committee grows from 50, 60, 500 of a special sort of internal committee. And they have this interesting relationship with politics. They don't want their members to run for high office. They don't think that in the end those sort of politicians are looking out for them. But they do believe that politics matters a lot. This is a sort of interesting duality. They work for the Republican Party, the party that had overseen emancipation, the party that was the party of the North, the party that was the hated enemy of the Confederate plantation owners, so even if it wasn't perfect, this sort of enemy of my enemy must somehow be closer to my friend. They work with them, they register people, sometimes they let their members run for low-level office. But they say in Washington, that's something distract, you know, the politicians running for these high offices are losing track of us, and we're gonna keep focused on what we're doing on the ground. So they participate in this, and over the course of the 1870s, while they're being intimidated, they start to come to the conclusions that some of the things that they had hoped would be true in Louisiana were not going to be true that much longer. And this helps us to sort of something else I'll come back to in a few minutes, of how to understand sequence and chronology. That
Adams never has a belief that some panacea, some utopia had been invented by emancipation. He never says, I thought at the end it was going to be perfect, it was a Camelot, and then it didn't last. But he does say, even though people are getting whipped and beaten and cheated, some things were still possible in the 1860s, and there were things that people could build on. And in retrospect, scholars a great deal think this is true. There are people who are accumulating property, black people, former slaves, even illiterate former slaves who are starting to accumulate bits of property in the 1860s and early 1870s. Sometimes at really surprising rates. Doesn't mean that it was that way for the majority of people, but there are these sort of possibilities that are being opened. And in starting in the early 1870s, he says, and then they start to close. And the way they start to close in Louisiana, which will seal echo, and with some differences, what we're going to see is the story of the entire South, is through an organization, an organized violent response to these manifestations of black power that goes from black political power, that goes from these sort of isolated people stopping a Henry Adams on the road to a much more systematic set of committees themselves with their own grassroots way of mobilizing ex-Confederates, especially ex-Confederate soldiers, especially, although often founded by sort of high-ranking officers, especially effective at mobilizing low-level Confederate privates and so on, into much more systematic tools where they're not worried about scaring one person or another, but figuring out how do we take control back? How is it that they can reassert the power of the ex-planter class, especially through the State Democratic Party? And so, in a series of famous massacres, especially the Colfax Massacre, where a group of white Republicans and black Republicans go inside a courthouse in Colfax, Louisiana, in order to claim what they say has been a stolen election, the white leagues and the white lines, these sort of later manifestations of these impulses that earlier created the Ku Klux Klan, gather around with guns and say, we're going to shoot you out. The Republicans inside, white and black, look out, count numbers, decide they're not going to be, you know, martyrs to history, and say, you know, this is it. We can't win this fight. Wave white flags, march out, and are shot down. And then many of them, including elected officers, you know, town officials, as I say, both white and black. Adams is watching all of these things and saying, if this is the weight that's going to come here, where's going to be the counterweight? People on his committee are saying, as soon as this happens, they say, how can there be a future here? And he says, let's wait one more year. He says, 1876 is presidential election year. And let's see what's going to happen before we give up on this, right? We've got, you know, these people, you know, many of, you know, he was born in Georgia, but many of these people are born in Louisiana and Mississippi. They have huge extended families. He says, you know, let's see if we can get some counter pressure. And in 1876, instead of things seeming to, you know, to get a counterweight, he comes out of that even more pessimistic. That he sees an extraordinary use of political violence in places like Louisiana and Mississippi, of these white leagues and white lines to put them down, to put down these organizations. He sees a National Republican Party that under Grant had sent people, not that Grant is any sort of idyllic type or an ideal, you know, or certainly not a racial egalitarian, but he hated disorder. And so when people would send him petitions saying things are getting out of hand down here, he believed in the army. He would send the army down, not as often as people wanted, but sometimes. But he sees in 1876, this is coming to an end. The Democrats are in control here, and the Republicans in D.C. are saying, let us have peace. Let's put all this behind us. 1878, he watches one more election to see if things will get better. When they don't, then 1879, they create this organization of 100,000 people to start this migration to Kansas. And this movement will create some of the things that then scholars later studied of the all-black towns in places like Kansas and Oklahoma, of whole townships that pick up and move from parts of the South and that move into these places in the Great Plains. Obviously never enough to be a majority or anything like it of a state of Kansas, but an important part of the post-emancipation life, of this impetus to move. The Adams story and the people he's connected with aren't the whole story of Reconstruction. But I think they touch upon several things that are really interesting and important about the era. One of the things they touch upon is the importance of organization.
And we'll come, and I'll sort of now, you know, go through these on a more national or at least regional level. So what's going on across the South or in the nation? That organization really matters, that people are organizing early, and they're organizing to get information and to try and put people together in a way that's going to make a difference, that's going to have an impact. The second thing that the story is going to indicate is that there are these moments of rise and fall, that it's not a single, here's hope, here's despair, but that there's a thousand little moments where people are judging. And they don't have what we have, right? They don't know how the story is going to end. And so in the midst of it, there are a thousand moments where they're saying, things look this way, but, like Adam saying, you know, I don't see much hope, but do I want to watch one more, you know, wait a little longer before I determine the end? Or I see all this hope, but do I want to be a little cautious before I think this is really going to last? But they're making, they don't know in the end these end results that we know. And capturing that sense that, so his story also captures for us the sense of how much fluidity, how much movement that's possible, how much it is that people are making different judgments at different times, and how much of what's going to happen seems to them to be contingent. In other words, not predetermined, something scholars worry about a lot, that things, you know, seem up in the air to them. They may be wrong. We may, with historical, you know, accuracy, be able to look back and say, here things, they were wrong. Here they thought there was hope, but hope had actually walked out the door 2 years before. But many of them, like Adams, have a sense of contingency, that everything is not yet totally predetermined, even if they know much more clearly than any of us could because they're seeing it, even if they know all the reasons to be skeptical or suspicious or doubtful, that there's also these openings of how is this going to happen, and when is it that the moment that the light starts to turn out for people? For what people is it in 1870, and what people is 1876, and for what group of people is it really not till the 1890s or the early 1900s when you really see segregation and disfranchisement come in? Another thing that it'll suggest to us that I'll, you know, walk through how it's become important nationally is that it's met by and it meets its downfall in large part if this is a sort of enormous organization of freed people. What beats it is also an enormous organization. And this is an enormous organization, largely built up of ex-Confederate ranks. Early on, in other parts of the South, through the Ku Klux Klan, which I'll talk about, and then by 1874 and 1875, through these white leagues and white lines, to claim local power. And that these groups are also extremely organized, and in some way, and in some uncomfortable way, also grassroots groups, if also different parts of the grassroots, obviously, aiming to claim local power for the Democratic Party, for the ex-planter class, for the ex-Confederates. And that what comes out of this is a politics that's highly organized and what some scholars call a paramilitary politics, in which we want to think about politics not just as sort of going and voting, because it was never going to be that simple, as Adams knows. When he goes to vote for the first time in 1870, there's, you know, white liners there with guns, and they say, you know, they're telling everybody, if you vote Republican, we're going to fire you, and if you tell other people to vote Republican, we're going to shoot you. And so what he and increasingly large numbers of other people do is they arrive with their own guns. And that what goes on at ballot places, one well-known scholar, Julie Saville, says, is not a recording of an opinion, but something like a fight, in which there's a thousand small wars of who's going to control this precinct enough to say, we can come in. And that this is not going to be decided by ideas, but in some level by force. And the final thing that the Adams story is going to suggest to us, that's going to be an important part of how historians understand Reconstruction, is to understand the relationship between Reconstruction and the political possibilities then, and the outcome of Reconstruction, and the thing that's going to come later in the period, in most parts of the South, which is the migration. That the next, if the sort of, you know, classic trajectories of African American history are Reconstruction, then Jim Crow, then migration, not to Kansas, not to Liberia, but to Chicago, to Harlem, to Philadelphia, later to Detroit, to Cleveland, of the how these stories are interrelated, what it was about political power that gave people hope in the South, and what it was about taking back this political power that gave people a sense that they might not, even if it was the place that they were born and the place that their families were, that it might not be sustainable, and how this is related to how they saw themselves.